from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. As part of our In My Experience series, spotlighting the personal stories of our listeners, we talk with a panel of former prisoners about their crimes, their experience inside prison, and their struggles to make it on the outside. Guests include Linda Field, former prisoner who served 19 years for killing her abusive husband, James Smith, a former prisoner who served 4 years and 8 months for assault with a deadly weapon, his hands, and Carl Irons, a former prisoner who served 24 years for second-degree murder, as well as Beverly Henry, a former prisoner who spent 40 years in and out of prisons for prostitution, theft, forgery, and armed robbery. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. In this Forum Hour, as part of our In My Experience series, spotlighting the personal stories of our listeners, we're talking with a panel of former prisoners about their crimes, their experiences inside prison, and their struggles to make it on the outside. And we have four of those former prisoners with us this morning, and I want to thank them all for being here. Linda Field is with us from Sacramento. She spent 19 years in prison for killing her abusive husband. And Linda Field, glad to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you.
We also want to welcome James Smith, who's here with us in studio, who served 4 years and 8 months in prison for assault and battery with a deadly weapon, his hands. Welcome, James Smith.
Thank you.
We also want to welcome Beverly Henry, who's with us by phone. She's been in and out of prison from 1970 until 2009 for selling heroin, prostitution, and armed robbery. And welcome, Beverly Henry.
Thank you so much.
Glad to have you. And also with us in studio is Carl Irons, who spent 24 years in prison for second-degree murder. He was in San Quentin and Solano and Soledad. And welcome, Carl Henry.
Thank you, Michael.
Carl Irons, excuse me. Thank you. Let me begin, Linda Field, with you. We're just coming off a program, as you may know, in the last hour about domestic violence, big national convention here in San Francisco. And let's talk about the crime that you were convicted of, which originally was a life sentence for killing your husband. You really, in a sense, felt you had nothing else in the way of option at that time, no shelters to go to or no way of at least combating the kind of problem you were facing?
That's true. At the time that it happened, which was in 1985, there were no shelters. And I had loaded my three kids up in the car time after time, driving up and down Highway 1 and the coast trying to figure out what to do. And there was no place to go. I had gone to my mom's house and she didn't have room, and she sent me back over and over, because in those days you didn't talk about what was going on. She knew it was bad, but she didn't know how bad it was.
We didn't know about battered women syndrome, for example, did we?
No, I didn't know about it. And I had been molested as a child from my grandfather, and I swore it would never happen to one of my kids. And I found out that it did happen to my daughter, and I just didn't know what to do. And the night that it happened, I disassociated. It's what happens when your subconscious mind takes over, and what you would not normally do as a person, I did. And when I killed my husband and I realized that I ended up turning myself in, because I just couldn't believe that I had done that.
You killed him knowing that he had molested your daughter, or you found that out later?
No, I knew at the time that he had molested her. And he had alienated me from friends. I no longer had friends. I was alienated from my family, because whenever I would go over there, he would call and need something, and I wasn't able to go anywhere. You know, I was isolated.
He was controlling your whole life, basically.
He controlled the money. He controlled everything.
And the strange irony in your story is that your son began to, a number of years later, after you'd been in prison for a number of years, began to believe that he was responsible for your husband's death.
Yes. The week after I committed this crime, my son, Matthew, turned 13. And what I didn't know is that he had stolen a cutlery set, and he had planned to become a man when he turned 13. And he was going to kill my husband. He was going to step up and become a man and protect me and his two sisters. and he was going to stop the abuse. And that was the first time that I thanked God that it was me that did it and not my son, because it weighs so heavy on your soul doing what I did. And I was just so thankful that it was not him.
You still feel guilty about it in some ways, don't you?
Yes. Yes, it's something that I will always feel guilty about. I mean, doing what I did, you cannot take into your own hands and do what I did. That's something that was up to God, not me. And even though it stopped the abuse for my children, I still feel guilty. I mean, I know that something had to be done to protect my children, and I did not know what to do. I wish that I had known something else, but I don't know what it would have been.
Well, you went
to that it wasn't my son.
You went to prison, and life in prison, I want to sort of get a sense from you. We're going to get a sense from all of our guests, because this is, in my experience, segment that we're doing here. And I should mention that thanks to a pro bono attorney and habeas corpus, you essentially got released after 19 years. But the sense of life in prison, you mentioned, for example, at Fontana that you had a nice guard, but many of those guards were hurting women, sexual put-downs, verbal abuse. Talk about that.
Yeah, you had some guards that were there for the right reason, because they cared. But then you had some that were there because they hated women, and they could take their abuse out on women any way they wanted. There was sexual abuse going on. There was physical abuse and a lot of verbal abuse. When I was at CCWF, which is in Chowchilla, we were on a month-down lockdown. And it was very difficult. You have eight women in a room and trying to get along. Luckily, my room was a room full of Christian women, and we all got along. But one day the COs decided to take away our brooms and our mop buckets because they decided that we were going to hurt each other with them. Well, we had been taking turns doing our laundry in it, and it just so happened that that day my underwear was being washed, and the officer came in and he wanted it, so I went to pick it up to dump my underwear out because I didn't want him touching that. And he lifted his arm as if he was going to backhand me, and he said, I ought to just... And my first reaction, I didn't say it out loud, but my first reaction was, go ahead, I've been married. He came very close to backhanding me.
Talking with Linda Field, who spent 19 years in prison for killing her abusive husband, and it's been tough being out too, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. It has. It's had its ups and downs. I'm living in a community now where my son and my daughter-in-law at first said, don't tell anybody about your past, but I felt like I had to. Because if I hid it, it would be like lying. And if people were going to like me, they needed to like all of me, not just part of me. And there was a couple of years there that it was rough. But now, it's really great. They accept me for who I am. They know about my past. But it's hard making decisions even now, because for so many years, I couldn't make any kind of a decision. And there's still times when I have to make a decision that it's very difficult. The first thing I wanted is I wanted a key. Because I wanted to be able to lock my own door. I didn't want to be locked in and have anybody make that decision. It's just recently. I got out in 2006, and it's just recently, after going through a lot of therapy, even on the outside here, that I'm no longer afraid of all men. There is a select few men that I'm still afraid of, which is great for a change, instead of being afraid of all men. But it's been a hard, long, hard haul. getting to that point.
Also stayed close with many of those who you did prison time with. I mean, it becomes almost like a family, doesn't it?
It is. It's like when women go to prison, they nest. It's inbred with us. We develop families inside. I mean, I have one person in there that I consider my sister. She's my sister of choice, Judy. And I've gone back and visited her inside. There's others that I still write, and they're family in there. When you develop family in there, you go home, and they're still in there, part of you is still in prison. I've gone back and visited at VSPW, which is the prison across the street. When they've had battered women awareness days, I've been able to go back in twice and talk to the ladies because they need to know that even though we're outside, we haven't forgotten them. When you're a lifer, you don't forget those that you leave behind. You still have to work to try to get them out, and that's what I'm doing. I love those ladies, and until they're out, part of me is still in prison.
Well, we're glad you're with us this morning. And again, Linda Field is with us from Sacramento, part of our series In My Experience, which is spotlighting the personal stories of our listeners, talking with people who have served time in prison. And James Smith is one of them. He's here with us in studio. 4 years, 8 months in California Rehab Center, now a warehouse supervisor in Oakland. One of the lucky ones, I might say, James, I mean, to have a job and everything. When you came out, you felt branded. And it's very difficult to get work, wasn't it?
Absolutely. You're not trusted. You're basically not an American anymore. Everything that people can go into prison for, you're automatically guilty for when you get out. I'm not a thief, yet people don't trust me around anything. They don't want to trust me. I'm
actually a pretty strong law and order guy, from what I understand.
Absolutely.
You? So
absolutely.
Suddenly, people see you in all criminal guises or all criminal activity because you have an ex-con.
Yeah, absolutely. My stepfather's a police officer. I have the utmost respect for police officers. I still never have anything bad to say about police officers, even though there are some recent events, but I I'm still very strong on it. I spent time in the military.
Marine, in fact?
Yes. Yeah. Anything I've ever done that was decent is now gone, and I'm just completely bad.
Because of an act which you take full responsibility for. I mean, there are a lot of people in prison who say, I didn't do it, probably more than are in prison who say, I did. But I give you kudos for at least owning up and saying, I did it, and I served my time, and I paid my debt.
That's the thing, is I have paid my debt, but the debt continues on for the rest of your life. It will never go away. They won't let you forget. I have applied for jobs that people begged me to take, and then couldn't get it because that one incident.
Which was assault with the deadly weapon being your hands. I mean, you went after somebody and you were pretty lubricated, weren't you, at the time?
I was indeed,
I'm not trying to excuse it, believe me. But then they kept putting you in rehab for alcohol problems and you really didn't even have an alcohol problem except in that incident.
No, they talk to you for a while and you convince yourself, maybe I am an alcoholic. And so I thought at first, okay, I'll go into the program because evidently I do have some sort of problem because some sort of control issue with alcohol in my system. I'm sorry, I'm not that well spoken.
No, you're doing fine. I want to get your story here, though, and I think you're getting at the sense of how much prison really could have helped you or did help you or didn't help you. For the most part, it wasn't much help at all in terms of leading you into a better direction or providing illumination. It does that for some people, of course.
You know, it did and it did not help. There were times when I was ready to give up and just go on ahead and do whatever. They taught you and heard you, and there's no rehabilitation in prison at all. There's no straighten up. I heard things, better ways to do crimes. That's all I heard. You know, I heard funding issues. The reason I was in the program is basically to keep the funding going. They weren't teaching me anything. You know, I took a anger management course because I thought, well, I got drunk and I hurt somebody. So evidently I do have an anger issue. I took that on my own. Nobody ever suggested that to me.
There's also a story that you told about being in prison early on, although separation went on by race, and you had kind of a white friend who you made in prison. You had to cut him off because of these racial lines that are so...
He was a friend of mine before prison. He was a good friend of mine. We'd gone out together. We just did the general socializing that people do, and he was a good friend of mine. And he happened to have gotten caught coming back across the border and went to prison. He was coming back across the border. I'm not going to talk about what he was doing because I don't think he really wanted to tell me what he was doing. And we were sitting on the yard and playing chess and eating and whatever. And somebody came and whispered in my ear, "You got to get up and come away from here. This is the white table." And I thought, you know, at first I looked at him like they were crazy. Like, what are you talking about? And he said, "You can't hang out with this dude anymore, and you can't play chess with this dude, and you can't share food with this dude, you can't do anything with him." And I said, "But I know him. He's a friend of mine. I've known him for a few years." They said, "You can't. If you do, we're not going to protect you, and they're gonna stab you up."
Have any advice for people who are going to prison or who have loved ones who are in prison in terms of just dealing with it? Any sense of hope that you can provide? I know, for example, you taught literacy for a while and it was very rewarding to you. Maybe you can give some wisdom here.
I don't want to get anybody in any trouble, but look, do your time. Mind your business. Don't join any gangs. Don't get any tattoos that you're going to regret. And stand your ground. You know, if you're being forced to do something, don't.
Again, James Smith here with us in studio, who served 4 years and 8 months in prison for assault with a deadly weapon, his hands. Beverly Henry is with us from Los Angeles. She's been in and out of prison from 1970 until 2009 for sales of heroin, prostitution, and armed robbery, and petty theft. And the armed robbery was really the sort of scarlet letter for you, Beverly Henry. I mean, in terms of the way people saw you and opening possibilities, wasn't it?
Well, when you are trapped in addiction, people have a certain stereotyping that they place people in that category. You're not trusted. You can't be trusted. You will go to jail. You are pretty much the lowest of the low. So I was marked way beyond going to state prison and going to CRC, the California Rehabilitation in the city of Narco. I had been marked way before then. You know, the armed robberies, all of my crimes, every single one is drug related. There was not one time that it was not, that it was for profit. It was all to secure that my drug habit could continue.
But the armed robbery specifically kept you from programs and really even...
You know, some people are allowed to go. We once had a system called work furlough where you get out like within 90 days of your release and you are allowed to go into a sober housing facility in your community, wherever you parole from, and you're allowed to obtain work if you can find work. And it's like an early release. And you stay there until you're able to get an apartment, move out on your own, and you're on parole. Well, those programs are not okay for people who have crimes of violence. So a lot of things, you know, fire camp, I was not allowed fire camp. I was told I couldn't go. when I was younger. You know, I had applied and asked, and they said, well, no, you have a crime of violence, which is armed robbery. Plus, I have one escape from attempted escape from CRC as a younger woman. And all of those things were stuff that was a red flag. You know, I couldn't do it.
Well, you were in prison, you've talked about it as being sort of like Linda Field was saying, establishing a family within prison, and yet you've also said that you yourself were a predator. What do you mean by that?
Well, in the system with the women, there is the predator and there is the victim, and you decide which one you're going to be upon walking in there. You know, you have women who never have one problem. You know, they're very quiet. They're very low key. They avoid trouble at all costs. They are not trying to break any rules. Myself, on the other hand, when I went in, I was very young. I was very impressionable. I definitely wanted to make a name for myself because I was trying to survive. So the bottom line to it all, I was scared to death. So instead of allowing you to see my fear or admitting my fear, because, you know, I'm taken from my home and placed in a place where there's women of all ages, all races, all types of crimes. So I need to establish, you know, my credibility. So what you do is you prey on someone who is much weaker than yourself, whose fear is, they're wearing it on their sleeve. You know, they have, you know, you push people around. You start getting money put on your books. You start taking canteen. You start overcharging people, selling them stuff and overcharging them. Those are predators. And I was in that category for a long period of time when I was doing time.
You feel bad about it now?
Oh, of course. You know, later years, as I got older and continued to enter the system, that type of behavior changed. I was no longer the young, crazy kid who wanted to make a name for herself. I wanted to figure out, how do I stop doing this?
Actually, I was just going to update. Now I understand you have been in a wheelchair, you've been homeless, you've had HIV. I mean, you've had a tough time.
Well, you know what? I left in 1990. I got busted in 1997. I made a $20 sale of heroin, which is 0.07 grams, if you can measure that. I made a sale to an undercover. I was whacked out of my mind. I was under the influence, of course. And I didn't realize I'm standing in front of an elementary school. So really, that's a life sentence in and of itself. You know, I had no clue that the school was in session. I made the sale. I get arrested a few moments later, and I end up with 15 years at 85%. So that meant you got to stay in there 12 years. That's 80% of 15.
Beverly, excuse me, we're coming up on a break, and I want to mention again Beverly Henry with us from Los Angeles, who has been in and out of prison for 40 years. We're also going to talk with, as part of this series we're doing, In My Experience, with Carl Irons, who's here with us in studio, who served time in San Quentin's Solano and Soledad. And we're going to find out about each of these people's lives now and their connection to their families and more. And, of course, we'll bring you into the conversation. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and as part of our series, In My Experience, we are spotlighting the personal stories this morning of our listeners, talking with a panel of former prisoners about their crimes, their experiences inside prison, and their struggles to make it on the outside. With us in studio is James Smith, who served 4 years and 8 months in prison for assault with a deadly weapon. With us also in studio is Carl Irons, who spent 24 years in prison for second-degree murder. And with us by phone, Linda Field, who spent 19 years in prison for killing her abusive husband. And Beverly Henry, who was in and out of prison from 1970 until 2009 for selling heroin and prostitution and armed robbery. And I should mention that today's show was produced with the help of the Public Insight Network, and you can join the network simply by visiting kqednews.org/publicinsight. That's kqednews.org/publicinsight. Public Insight. Beverly Henry, just one more question. Are you off drugs, and what's life like for you?
Well, I've been out since October 5th, 2009. I went into a drug treatment program, Cry Help Incorporated, located in North Hollywood. I spent 7 months there dealing with my addiction. Man, it's been an experience. I stayed 7 months. I graduated. I now have been clean 2 years.
Well, congratulations. And you were, using all the time you were in prison, too. Right?
Oh, I used off and on whenever it was available in the prison system. In fact, I ended up testing HIV positive, which was all due to using drugs with someone in prison who was, in fact, already infected.
But you've become a certified HIV educator, we should mention.
Yes. Since I've been home, I took the class for about 5 days, and I am now certified by the state of California to test for HIV and teach HIV.
Well, congratulations, and congratulations on being clean for 2 years. That's remarkable, and that's wonderful. And
well, it would be nice if I could get a speaking, because that's what I like to do is go out and speak to people and schools and, you know, try to help the people of color in all communities that, you know, for some reason in 2012, they act like this virus does not exist.
Well, you may have done yourself a service in that sense. We have a lot of listeners here, and if anybody is interested in finding a place for Beverly, please get in touch with us, and we'll see what we can do to make that happen. In the meantime, we want to talk to Carl Irons, who's here in studio and waiting patiently. Actually served nearly 25 years from 1985 to 2009, is now, at City College, going on to San Francisco State next. You led what you described as a nefarious life when you were a young man. What do you mean by that?
I moved to San Francisco straight out of high school and got in and didn't intentionally get outside the law, but it was very easy in 1968 to get involved in the drug culture. And my life drifted pretty far away from the mainstream. By the early 70s, I was smuggling cocaine, living predominantly outside the law. Got out of the cocaine smuggling business when one of my partners got arrested. But I was addicted to the adrenaline, so I couldn't completely get out of the dealing drugs and that basic lifestyle. The excitement really had hold of me.
Well, and so did prison, and yet, for close to a quarter of a century, and yet, unlike James Smith and so many others, you learned a lot about yourself in prison and went on kind of a spiritual quest.
I did. I mean, when I got arrested, it was obvious that I was on the wrong – that finally got my attention enough to realize I was on the wrong track. Now, that doesn't mean I had any idea what was right, but I knew I needed to make some changes. And they came slowly over time. By the time I went to prison, I had pretty much stopped using all drugs except alcohol, and I don't deserve any particular credit for that. I mean, I stopped enjoying marijuana. I got more paranoid than enjoying the high. I stopped using cocaine when I stopped smuggling because it got too expensive. But on the other hand, I started using methamphetamines pretty heavily. But eventually, when I got arrested, I stopped using that. I quit drinking when I'd been in prison about 6 months. We made some Pruno, some homemade wine, and I was starting to gather the stuff to make another batch. And I said to myself, you know, I don't need this. In the long run, this is going to cause problems I don't need.
There was a calculated decision to change in your life, really.
Yeah?
I mean, to transform you.
Yeah, it was a decision to change, and it took me a long time and several different factors to kind of get a handle on how.
Well, you got some help too, though. I mean, from volunteers and in Quentin, you got some help?
I got a tremendous amount of help. San Quentin in particular. I started my time in Soledad. I was there about 6 years. But eventually I managed to get San Quentin. And because that's in a populated area, a metropolitan area, and it's a liberal area, there are a lot of volunteers there. A lot of self-help programs available.
I may have been one of your volunteers. I actually did some volunteer work at Quentin a number of years ago. There were rehab opportunities too, right?
Yeah, and as James said, the prison doesn't rehabilitate anybody, but there are some opportunities available if a person chooses to take them. And for me, there were several that that came along at the time when I was open to them, a program called Kairos, which is a spiritual retreat weekend held by the Christian chapels at San Quentin, the Alternatives to Violence Project, which at the time was going strong at San Quentin. I'm still an Alternatives to Violence Project facilitator. Just this last weekend, I helped facilitate one of the workshops in Oakland, a community workshop.
And still a Buddhist?
I'm still a Buddhist. I was ordained. I went through my Jukai ceremony 10 years ago.
And mixed race background. How did that work out in prison? Or was it a problem? Or
no, it wasn't. I appear to be completely white, and I'm actually predominantly Welsh and Cherokee, but I usually describe myself as a Heinz, 57 varieties. I've got a real mixed background. But I was treated as white in prison, and that gave me a lot of advantages. That combined with the fact that I was in for killing somebody, which basically, as bizarre as this is and as sick as it is, being a murderer in prison made me an aristocrat.
Because you were a murderer.
Yeah.
You had murder on your jacket.
Yeah.
It's been a tough adjustment, though. I mean, all those years you spent in prison, notwithstanding, it's been tough for you. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And in some ways easier than others, but without – 25 years in prison, there are so many things that were – things in society have changed a lot, some technological changes. And the deprivation that I went through for 25 years made me unprepared for even to return to the society that I knew, much less a new one.
Well, but also you've come out and you've said you've undergone some depression and PTSD and anxiety attacks, all those kinds of things which do come out often of prison experience.
And I know besides that, I also know that I have something – if it's not survivor's guilt, it's something very similar to that because so few lifers get out. I had a life sentence. I was found suitable for parole by the board three times. Twice the governor reversed my grant of parole and kept me in. So like I say, so few lifers actually get out of prison. I know there's something similar to survivor's guilt.
What about the other advantages, though, in being a lifer and being white or seen as white?
It made the time in prison easier. It made it very easy to avoid getting wrapped up in any gangs and stuff like that. The one time I had a friend that I'd made in prison, he was a barber and he was black. And he was cutting my hair regularly simply because he was the best barber on the yard where I was. And somebody took exception to that once. Said, you know, you can't have a black guy cut your hair. I said, you know, and he didn't tell me himself. He sent word through somebody else. My response was, tell him to sharpen something and come after me because he hasn't chosen my friends now. Up to this point, he's not going to start now. And the fact is, he could have killed me. I wasn't that tough. I'm not that tough now, you know. But the fact that I was a lifer made him think twice before he did it.
Yeah. Again, Carl Irons here with us. Spent 24 years in prison for second-degree murder. He was in San Quentin, Solano, and Soledad. And I want to ask each of you about your connections now to your family. And Carl, let me begin with you. I know you have a son.
I have a son. He's a police officer in Aurora, Colorado. I chalk that up to teenage rebellion, and I'm really proud of him. I'm glad he made the choices he did. I wasn't around to raise him. I went to prison when he was 9, so my mother basically raised him. My mother's dead now. And my son, he liked skiing, so he applied to every college in Colorado when he got out of school, I think. And he went back there and he found a woman that he's married to. And they have a fairly close-knit extended family, which is really good for him because that's something I could never give him.
Well, you can give him love, and you do, I assume.
I try to. We're not completely estranged. I try to let him – I basically abandoned him when he was 9 years old, and I understand the reasons why we're not close. I try to always let him know that I love him and that I'm available if he wants to make the relationship closer, try to stay in touch. And I hope someday he's willing to.
Linda Field, you have a daughter and become closer to her, haven't you?
I have two daughters and one son.
Two daughters and one son. I'm sorry.
Yeah, and I dearly love all three of them, but it's difficult because whenever something goes wrong in their families, I feel responsible because I wasn't there for them when they were growing up. They were raised by my father mainly, because my mother died a year after I went into prison. But I try to be as close as I can to them. But I am living in Downeyville, and my son lives there, and my two daughters live in, one lives in Jackson and one lives in Ione. Both, you know, all in California, but it's difficult because as much as I love them and I think they love me, being gone all those years does put a certain barrier there.
And Beverly Henry, let's talk to you about your family. You have built up a closer relationship with your daughter, I understand. Beverly? Oh, I'm sorry. We have to either try to get her back or find out what happened. Talk about your family, James Smith. I know it was tough having your mom come visit. You didn't want her to come visit you, didn't you?
I wouldn't let her come. Yeah. I told her she couldn't come. I wouldn't see her if she did. I couldn't look her in the eye. I didn't want her to see me there. It was not appropriate. It was shameful. And I don't think I'm ever going to live it down. I have humiliated them. I humiliated myself. My stepfather's a police officer. I don't even know how you would explain that to other people. I don't even know how he would explain, where's your son? My son's in prison.
So the sense of stigma was really something that you were battling as far as your family was concerned, from the time you went in, yeah?
Yep. I didn't tell them where I was for the first 6 months. Nobody knew.
What about when you got out?
I see them now.
Yeah?
They seem to be okay with it, but I'm still not okay with it. My mother suffers from Alzheimer's. That's 5 years that I lost with her, and it's nobody's fault but my own. I'm a little distant from my sister's children. I don't know why. I think they know, and
of course, that's something you can change, right? Something you have the power to alter. Right?
Truth is, I don't know how. I mean, how do you look a child in the eye and say, you know, your uncle's not a bad guy?
You just did it. Let me go to Beverly on this. Beverly, you came out with all this stigma too. Maybe you can help James here, but also talk about how you forged a better relationship with your child.
You know, I had a daughter. I have one daughter. She's 35. And you know what? She started out, bless her heart, all wrong. I delivered her in prison. She was picked up at 4 days old by my mom and dad. I was asked to remove myself from the family home because I was the only active drug addict and going to prison, and it was just bad. And I wasn't ready to change, you know. So for 34 years, this daughter had very little contact with me. Well, I need to tell you today, she's 35. She has an 11-month-old baby, which is my granddaughter. She lives 10 minutes away from where I'm staying with some friends because I'm still homeless, mind you. You know, I live wherever I can, and I pay there. I'm on disability, but I sat with this girl for months, even when I was in the drug program. I didn't cut any corners. I didn't lie to her face. Every question she asked me, I answered it. And I told her, you know, it had nothing to do with her. It had to do with me having problems that I didn't know how to deal with. And you know what? My daughter and I've never been closer to a human being as I am to her today. I have tons of nieces and nephews because I come from a family of 8 children. And all my brothers and sisters have more than one child. I don't have any problem with these kids. You know, what they do ask me is, hey, what will happen if, and I keep them, you know, posted on, look, this is the way you need to go. Because if you follow the path I took, then you better be ready to do the things that happened to me, and you don't want to be inside. So, you know, a lot of that guilt and stuff that we carry, we hold on to it. You know, our families, most families, they love you no matter what. You know, it's us that can't really, you know, get past it, because for so long, you know, and even now, it'll flare up, because I'm like, I don't deserve this girl to be in my life. You know, I was a drug addict, a whore, I was all these things, you know, and I mean, she should be ashamed of me, but that's not true.
She loves you. Yeah, Beverly Henry again with us from Los Angeles. We've got a little bit of time left. I want to open the phone lines and bring our listeners into this. And you can talk about your own relationship to prison, if you have had any time in prison or had anybody in your family in prison, survival in prison and the difficulties faced, particularly not only there, but once getting out. Particularly also interested to hear from some of your relationship with family and how that has all worked out. I've said before, my sister was married for many years to a man who went away to prison for a number of years. It was very difficult for my nieces, and very difficult for the kind of life that they had to struggle with that stigma and so forth. I'd like to hear from some of you, and please feel free to ask questions of our guests. This is part of our In My Experience series. Our toll-free number is available right now. It's 866-733-6786. We do welcome your calls, also welcome your emails. Again, the toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Email address is forum@kqed.org. Feel free to email us or go to our website. Our website is available to you, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment and post any questions or comments you have there. And you can also, of course, do the same thing on Facebook. Remind you of who we have with us this hour here in studio, Carl Irons, who spent 24 years in prison for second-degree murder at San Quentin, Solano and Soledad, and James Smith, who served 4 years and 8 months in prison for assault with a deadly weapon, and that was his hands. And with us by phone, Linda Field from Sacramento, who spent 19 years in prison for killing her abusive husband, and Beverly Henry, who was in and out of prison from 1970 until 2009 for selling heroin, for prostitution, and for armed robbery. Ken from Livermore writes, "Wow, these stories really cut to the bone. I feel for your guests and what they've had to go through. Normally, I don't have much pity for those who were sent to prison believing they deserve punishment. Isn't that what prison is? Punishment first, then a source, probably a poor source, of rehab second. Having much to offer, I wish all your guests the best possible chance to find peace and maybe genuine love in your lives." Amy writes, "I applaud all your guests for their courage, their wisdom about their lives, and their redemptive growth. The penal and legal systems have much to learn from these individuals, as does our society." So some real strong sentiments there from listeners right off the bat. And again, I thank all our guests for being here. It takes a good deal of courage to come and expose yourself in this way and to talk about these very personal stories and what they've had to vie with and contend with. And let me go to our callers. We begin with you, Joy from Cupertino. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm just calling in comment. I listened to the last caller talk about her experiences. My sister is in prison. She's serving an 18 and a half year sentence. And I can say honestly that the effect it's had on the whole family is devastating. She has 2 children. She has 3 siblings. My parents are raising her kids. They're in their mid-70s. I think that the experience of the person who's incarcerated, I think it's great that they can work really hard to reestablish their lives and their relationships. But the far-reaching effects on their children and on their family members and financially and then also emotionally, and it's just a huge burden for us to carry.
I think you said the key word. It's devastating.
It's devastating. She's only 6 years into her sentence. Those children, we have to financially take those children and just all the support that has to go into those kids. We have to take them to visit their parents twice a year. They live in another state. It is it's not easy. For my sister, it's easy because she sits there. And I'm not saying it's easy all the way around. I know it's difficult for her as well in her own way. But it's much more difficult, I think, on those of us who support her and who support her children. And we're trying to really, do right by them. We all have college educations. We all went to school. I knew of no one who went to prison until my sister went to prison. And then people start coming out of the woodwork and saying, oh, I know someone who's gone to prison. And then you find out a lot of people, they don't want to talk about it.
Well, it is a stigma. And Joy, thank you for that call, as we've been hearing from James and others here this morning. And let me get another caller on, and that's you, Suzanne. Welcome. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I just want to thank all of the people that you've had on for speaking so honestly and heartfelt. To just, you know, I've been thinking a lot about this because I have a son that was in jail, and I certainly never expected him to be there, and has a heroin addiction problem, which, you know, he's been working on and is good for now. But the honesty thing is really appreciated. And I've learned so much. I would have been dismissive of so many people. So I learned a lot from him and from people like the program today, because you understand how hard it is to pick yourself up and do these, you know, sort of straighten yourself out. So I commend all your speakers today.
Well, and thank you for that call. And it is tough. In fact, Carl Irons, let's talk to you about this. It's been really difficult. I mean, you've used Pell Grants and loans and everything to go to school, highly commendable, but getting work has been difficult.
Yeah, it has. excuse me. And, of course, it doesn't help that I got out when unemployment was relatively high. They could have let me out when unemployment was 3%. I would have appreciated it. I'd like to make a comment on something the previous caller said, the first caller. I think she's right. It is much, much harder on our families, our children, our parents, the people who love us, than it is on those of us who are in prison. And that doesn't mean it's easy on those of us in prison. But I really see the damage and the emotional stress that our families go through. And I think she's right. It's much harder on the people who love us.
Well, and that gets back to your story, James Smith, because when you were released, you felt you had no place to go. In fact, I believe you wanted to go talk to your parole officer about going back into prison.
I got out of prison and I went to a program, and I faked it, basically. I said what they wanted me to say, and I did what they wanted me to do. And I was there because I had nowhere to go, and, you know, I thought, well, this can't possibly hurt me. So I got kicked out of that program. My funding ran out and, you know, I hadn't done anything. They just decided that it was time for me to go, and I went into a sober living home.
Beverly's gone. I'm getting her.
And I walked around there for a while, and then one day I realized that this is worse than anywhere I'd ever been. There was drugs and alcohol and everything else. I walked down the hall one day, and I just stopped in the middle of the hall and looked down, and I was in my socks, and there was a needle on the floor. I was about to step on it. So I thought, well, I have to leave here because I will do something. And I went to my parole officer, and I asked him if he could just put me back in prison until my parole was over. That way I wouldn't have this tail anymore, and I could at least go somewhere familiar, come back here to the Bay Area. Well, he said no, and he got me into a veterans program where I was very happy.
Because you were an ex-Marine, as we said earlier. Yeah.
Yes.
Let me get Cindy on next. Cindy, join us. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you, Michael. I just wanted to share that my 28-year-old son just was sentenced to life in prison. But I do have a comment regarding the effect on the family. It definitely is devastating. But I also wanted to make a connection with James and let him know that it is my son's faith and his belief in God that has given him the ability to forgive himself, which I hope that James will discover. And, James, I would myself reach out to you and let you know that I'm here for you if you ever seek someone to talk to, because I really believe in the human connection and the sharing that can be done in these connections that are made. So don't ever feel like you are alone, and God bless you.
Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Well, we've got about less than a minute left here, and let me, Beverly Henry, are you hopeful as you look ahead?
Am I what?
Hopeful. Are you hopeful?
Oh, well, yes, I am. I get discouraged, you know, because here I sit. I'm a very educated woman, and I sit with all this knowledge, and I really just want to be a motivational speaker, but I don't know. For the life of me, I haven't been able to make the right connections. I'm turning 63 in the morning, hopefully.
Oh, well, and happy birthday ahead of time. Like I said, we hope that maybe someone will find a way for you. We got seconds left here. Wanted to, Linda Field, you sound pretty positive about the future, are you?
Yes, I am. I'm a volunteer dispatcher for the Downeyville Volunteer Fire Department. I've got friends and I've got faith. And I'm looking forward for whatever is to come.
And we hope the best for you, for all of you, Carl Irons.
Yeah, I'm always hopeful about the future and very appreciative of the moment.
And James Smith.
I'm going to keep on. I'm going to keep going. That's all there is to it.
Well, we wish the best for you, for all of you, and thank you so much for sharing your stories with us. This is Forum. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. It's been part of In My Experience, spotlighting personal stories of our listeners. And we thank them all. And we thank you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you. We also thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Tina Larberg, Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.